never make it back to Lake Michigan. It would evaporate or disappear in production through what's called consumptive use. Ezra Meyer of Clean Wisconsin is also concerned about lake water quality. Foxconn plans to pipe its industrial sewage to the Racine wastewater treatment plant. Meyer wonders if Racine could properly treat the chemicals before discharging to the lake, or would Foxconn?
Is Foxconn going to do things up at the plant to take care of the chemical constituents that would be in there that would be of concern in the lake? You know, we've looked around the world at Foxconn's other manufacturing facilities that are similar to the one that they're proposing here, and there's a lot of nasty chemicals in there.
Jenny Trick is with the Racine County Economic Development Corporation. She says she hopes Foxconn gets the clean water it needs. She says she's confident the local drinking water and wastewater treatment plants would protect Lake Michigan.
There's always the concern that people are good stewards, but I'm thankful that we have some very good partners that have some very high success rates to make sure that this natural resource is protected.
This spring, the DNR is expected to make its recommendation on the Great Lakes water diversion request involving Foxconn. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now 11 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Let's check WGTD sports and weather. The NBA, the Bucks and Bulls both off last night. Tonight, the Bucks host Houston and the Bulls host Memphis. Over in the NHL, the Blackhawks beat Colorado in overtime last night, 2-1. They're off tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday the 7th. Not a bad day, partly sunny and seasonal. Today's high 30. Tonight, cloudy and 19. Tomorrow, Thursday, partly sunny and 32. This morning, a little breezy, wind from the northwest at 14. Sunshine and 24 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, featuring Easter candy, new apparel, and garden accessories in its recently remodeled gift shop. Open Monday through Friday from 9 until 6 and Saturday from 9 until 5. More information at jackanddrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll be hearing from Jennifer Sassaman from the UW Parkside Theater Department, and we'll also be hearing from Doug Instanis from the Racine Theater Guild about two different theatrical productions currently on stage here in southeastern Wisconsin. Stay with us. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I am happy, as always, to be across the table for this interview from Jennifer Sassaman, Assistant Professor of Theatrical Arts at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And Jennifer joins us, of course, quite often to talk about the various things that are going on with the theater department at Parkside. And we're actually talking about a play that has already opened, I believe, last weekend, and it's for once actually it isn't that uncommon, but once again it's a play that actually I've never encountered. I've scarcely even heard the title, but even the little I know now, it sounds like a very, very intriguing addition to the Parkside Theater schedule. So you still have opportunities to see One Man, Two Governors by Richard Bean. And Jennifer Sassaman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you so much. It's always lovely to be here.
Good to have you here. And it really is kind of nice when a theater department, or for that matter, a community theater or professional theater, offers up to the public something that is a little bit out of the ordinary. At least this play strikes me as that. Is this some sort of a chestnut or classic that everyone should already know and recognize, or is it a little bit out of the ordinary?
No, it's quite new, actually. I mean, it's within the last 5-6 years. Mm. So the what people might be familiar with, if they're familiar with theater history at all, is the play that it is and a modern adaptation of, which is the Carlo Goldoni 18th century Italian comedy, The Servant of Two Masters, which is based in the Commedia dell'arte tradition. Commedia dell'arte is a comedic improvisational form of theater that emerged during the Italian Renaissance. Mm. And this was, if you've seen the show Whose Line Is It Anyway? I mean, that level of skilled hilarity. People would develop stock characters over the course of their career. They would just play one part. You know, you could be 85 years old and still be playing the young lover because that was this stock character that you had developed. They would develop, like, specific shtick that they called their zany or their lotzi. And there was just these comedic bits that they honed to perfection and audiences knew about them. So they would go out into the streets and they would be given like the basic outlines of a scenario. This is what's going to happen. And then they would improvise the whole play. And this was extremely popular and very funny, very physical. And that was happening in Italy, and it spread out across Europe. The theatrical traditions were really popular. The groups would go and tour throughout the continent. And in the mid-18th century, a very famous Truffaldino, who was the stock character of the servant, the kind of the gluttonous servant who was always scheming to have food or hook up with a certain woman, a very famous one commissioned a play that sort of took a lot of the situations that were familiar, that were successful, and to actually script it. So it is a play based on what succeeded in improvisation, and it left windows for this Truffaldino to just sort of stop doing the play and start improvising with the audience.
Ah, so this was, again, commissioned by someone who was a well-known performer in Commedia dell'arte.
Yes.
But this would have been an instance of some kind of scripted work being created that sprang up from that tradition of improvisation. So it would be as though somebody took the TV series Whose Line Is It Anyway and tried to craft some kind of sitcom or something a little more scripted, a little more set in stone, but based on the spirit of improvisation and still allowing for
it. Well, and the success of improv. Like, we've done this bit 17 times, and in this time we were pirates, and in this time we were bank robbers, but every time the way we did X, Y, and Z made people laugh. So let's write it down.
Ah, and let's keep it.
yeah. Use it. Keep it, yeah. So in 2011, the National Theatre in London wanted to do a comedy. They were really interested in working with James Corden, who now hosts the Late Late Show that this does so many funny comedic sketches. They wanted to do a comedy, and they were really thinking about doing Servant of Two Masters with him as the centerpiece, the servant.
Mm.
And they decided that they would hire Richard Bean to write a modern adaptation of it. So One Man, Two Governors, instead of The Servant of Two Masters, is set in Brighton, England in 1963. And it follows all the same plot points, and it's very convoluted. But, you know, basically two sets of lovers by circumstance are being kept apart. And this one guy is trying to be the full-time valet to these two different people and the two governors. And he's not smart enough. I mean, it's a 24/7 job as is, and he's not smart enough to pull it off.
Mm.
So, you know, it's the single day while he's trying to make this happen and all of the ridiculous foibles that befall because, you know, he mixes up the envelopes for wrong people and, you know, he winds up telling people that the person that they're in love with is dead because he's just trying to make up a scheme to cover why he has something he shouldn't have. And so it's very funny. And I happened to see it a few years ago, two, three years ago. The National Theatre broadcasts their shows all over the world. I don't know if anyone of your listeners has seen, but if you go to nationaltheatrelive.com, you know, they do all these plays. They film these extremely well-done shows. And in England, what they'll do is they'll broadcast it live all over the UK while it's happening, while that performance is happening. And then they take this recorded version and they send it out to Kenosha, to Racine, to Milwaukee, to Chicago, all over. And so I was teaching theater history and literature. That's one of the courses I teach at Parkside. And I was having my students read The Servant of Two Masters because we were in the Italian Renaissance section. And I noticed that the National Theater Live was broadcasting this modern version of Servant of Two Masters. So I offered it as extra credit to my students. They wanted to go and see it and talk about the comparisons between the two scripts. And I figured if I was offering it as extra credit, I should probably go as well so I would know what they were talking about. So I took my then 3-year-old daughter to see it. And I have never laughed so hard ever at any performance. I mean, I've always thought that Noises Off is the funniest play that I've seen. And this is probably a tiny bit funnier than Noises Off. I still think Noises Off is a brilliant comedy. But it's that level of brilliant comedic timing kind of thing.
By the way, just to clarify, when you say you went to see this, so where did you go?
I went to a movie theater outside of Milwaukee.
So this was like the HD simulcast from the Metropolitan Opera.
Exactly.
This was that kind of thing, but in movie theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, so for example, this week on March 8th, I'm not sure which theater locally, but I know that the Benedict Cumberbatch Hamlet, which is the best Hamlet I've ever seen, they're rebroadcasting that. And highly recommend people go see that. It's very good.
That's fascinating.
But yeah, if you go to National Theater Live, you can see all kinds of performances.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, how often is the original play one?
Servant of Two Masters.
Servant of Two Masters. How often is that ever done?
Frequent. It's sort of along the lines of like A Midsummer Night's Dream. You know, not quite as familiar as that, but the first time I saw it was at the Philadelphia Theater Company in 1996.
Okay.
And the last time I saw it was at a theater company in Montgomery, Alabama, just 6 years ago.
Okay.
So it's not as done as Shakespeare, but I think companies that like doing classical works, it's pretty well known.
Pretty high up the list.
Yeah.
I only ask because sometimes there are works that are historically very significant and influential, maybe groundbreaking, but that doesn't mean they're still done with any frequency at all.
Right.
Sometimes it's that they were important in their own moment, but now
they served as source material for Shakespeare's comedies.
So you hear about them more than you actually get to encounter them. So it sounds like the original version is still very much in circulation.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, part of the fact that the comedy isn't based on what was happening in mid-century 1700s Italy. You know, it's not a political satire that doesn't translate because we don't know who any of these people they're talking about. It's about, I'm really hungry, and I'm going to do everything I can to eat. And like, hey, look over there. And while they're distracted, you shove as many meatballs in your mouth as possible. It just doesn't stop being funny.
Mm.
And it also, you know, if you have a really skilled comedic improviser as the Truffaldino, or, you know, in the case of One Man, Two Governors, as the Francis, they're riffing, they're making stuff up on the spot. And so, you know, that's in no way rooted in what was happening in 18th century Italy. It's right now. It's specific to that group of audience members.
Excellent. For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Jennifer Sassaman about the current production at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. It is a new play called, or a relatively new play called, One Man, Two Governors by Richard Bean, based on a classic Italian comedy from a couple of centuries ago called A Servant of Two Masters. This opened last weekend at Parkside, but is still running this coming weekend.
That's correct.
So you still have an opportunity to enjoy this. So are we talking about literally governors? Or, I mean, exactly, I suspect not. In what way is that term being used in the play?
So in England, a governor basically means someone's boss.
Mm.
So, you know, if you've ever seen, you know, in Mary Poppins or any movie set in Britain, like a cab driver will, you know, someone will hop in a cab and say to a cab driver, take me to Parliament. And he'll say, right, you are, governor. Mm. And it really is just like, it's just a term that you would say.
Almost like sir, I suppose.
It's like sir, but it specifically, you know, means someone who is employing someone else. Mm. So it doesn't, you know, in a cab situation, they're employing you for the 10-minute cab ride. But, you know, when in the play, for example, when people are saying, you know, so I've got a letter for your governor, or, you know, where's your governor? I want to have a word with your governor. They mean specifically, I want to talk to your boss.
Mm.
It's just a term that would have been really well known. Yeah, and there are some, you know, there are some slight language difficulties. Like anyone in the UK would just know that a governor is you know, someone's boss, but that's not necessarily something people would know here unless they watch a lot of Downton Abbey or something.
Right, exactly. Right.
Or the Great British Baking Show. But, you know, there's one joke that I think is so funny that I would not have gotten when I mean, I remember watching the original production. So again, it's set in 1963. And at the start of Act Two, this woman has this impassioned speech about how I think in 20 years there's going to be a woman in 10 Downing Street. And she's going to be like so maternal and loving. And, you know, and she, and I'm listening to the audience laugh. And it made me think, oh. So Margaret Thatcher would have been prime minister in 20 years, but the woman that she's describing, this, like, you know, this harbinger of peace and equality, like, that is, that's not what happened during the Thatcher administration.
Right. That's not her persona at all, or what
right.
she is. That is not
the
how
Iron
she is
Lady.
Remembered. Yes.
Right. So, you know, British audiences know this, you know, that's their contemporary, you know, their recent political history. So most people who are going to see the play get this. And I remember on Saturday night, I did hear a few people laughing, and I'm looking around the audience and, you know, I see that it is people who were old enough to remember the Thatcher administration. Mm. But, you know, that joke, we've talked about that joke. It's really funny, but there's no real way, unless we kind of like time out. Let's explain the Thatcher administration.
Right. So it'd be like if a Brit came to see a play that had some kind of inside joke about, I don't know,
Reagan
or Grover Cleveland or something, that they would, yeah, that would most likely sail over their heads.
I don't know if I would get a joke about Grover Cleveland.
Yeah, right, yeah. So we've explained the term governor. And then what about the man then? Tell us more about exactly what this, I'll call him the James Corden character or the Truffaldino character.
Francis.
What is his role? I mean, what is he supposed to be doing for these two bosses? Is he the secretary of both of them or other duties?
It's funny because the term man actually is a British term as well. So like when someone is looking for Francis, they'll say, I'm looking for your man. You know, So in the same way that governor is a term for boss, your man is going to be your servant. For it's like it's part valet, it's part or butler, it's part secretary, it's part, you know, bodyguard for, you know, one of the characters is actually a woman in disguise. She's disguised as her twin brother. And so she's hired Francis because she sees him get into a bit of a fight with someone. So she's like, oh, hey, I need a bit of muscle. Will you be my... Oh, dear.
Let's pause that for a second. All right, phone call dispatched. Sorry about that. And so now we know a little bit more about the long list of duties that that the man mentioned in the title has. And now the fact that he's in the situation where he is trying to perform all of these duties for two different bosses, two different governors.
And is just not smart enough to pull it off. I think, you know, if you had someone who was really whip smart, they could totally, you know, there'd be enough downtime that they could probably keep it up for a little while. But he's constantly forgetting that he's already taken care of one person's trunk and the person says, well, take care of my trunk. He's like, I just did the trunk. Oh, no. Expletive.
Yeah. So is it that the two governors don't know that he's splitting his time? And why is he splitting his time?
Money.
Oh, okay. So he's
hungry. So the play begins and he says, I haven't eaten in 16 hours. So all he can think about is food. And the governors are, you know, one of them has just murdered was killed someone in a fight and is afraid that they'll go to jail for it. So they have his two governors are actually a couple, and they split up after the death of Rachel's twin brother, and they're meeting up in Brighton somewhere, and they're just trying to find each other, and they're trying to get enough money so they can escape to Australia, which neither of them want. There's a lot of jokes about how awful Australia is. Do you like opera? Why are you going to Australia? So Francis is, you know, he's very hungry, and they're so preoccupied with finding each other and getting the money and getting away from the police that they're not interested in food. And so when one governor won't pay him till the end of the week, he takes this other job. He's just trying to eat.
Mm, cute. Reminds me of my days early in the 90s where I was working here full time, but working part time at Carthage. Mm-hmm. And there was a time where they asked me if I could also, in addition to teaching a few voice lessons on my day off, could I also direct the chamber singers? And so I have these memories of racing over to Carthage on my lunch break, and I would just have it timed exactly down. And sometimes, you know, on the way, I'm doing, you know, other trying to get my head around whatever, and just that little bit of juggling was just about more than my addled brain could manage. And now those two parts of my life are a little more sort of discreet in the schedule, and it works just great. But that mad dash, and so I'm in my mind just trying to sort of multiply that by 10, and that's probably what we're talking about in terms of this man caught between two bosses and trying to make it all work. Is this, I suspect it's not a play with just three characters in it, although
there are 21 actors
wow.
in this play. We have a live band that performs both in the pre-show era at time in the pre-show section, and then between each of the numbers or between each of the scenes, because these are we have six different locations and they're fairly substantial sets. Because
wow.
we have to go from the interior of one person's house to the exterior of the pub to the interior of a restaurant to the pier, to Brighton Pier. If anyone's been to England, I mean, it's this beautiful, gigantic pier.
Wow.
And so it takes time. And I think the band premise is brilliant, because if you listen to music, you know, it puts you in a frame of mind. But if you listen to that music performed live, when you're at a concert, you know, people are, you know, jumping around in their seats. And the music was all written. It's all part of the show. When you lease the rights to the play, you get the sheet music that
okay.
was created. And it's very similar to Beatles music of the time. There are certain songs I listen to, and it's like I can hear the three Beatles songs that's kind of a braid of.
Okay.
So, yeah, we have, you know, and each member from the cast gets up at some point and performs with the band, and it's crazy. The premise that our scenic designer came up with, I think, is really interesting. He came up with the idea that we were in a 1963 television studio filming like a Saturday Night Live kind of a show, like, you know, where they'll do the scene and then it cuts over to the band while the set is being, you know, put together for the next segment. And I really like this because, you know, when I went to my production team, I had initially said, there's this rich tradition of Commedia. We know about the rules. We know about the colors. We know about how it worked. I'd love to incorporate some of that. I feel like, just as a historian, I think that would be really interesting. And the idea of TV appeals to me in particular because, you know, in 1500s Italy, there were really big, expensive theaters that you could, you know, spend a fortune on a dress and go out to be seen and watch the play. But Commedia was in the streets. Commedia was there for everybody. And if you think about, you know, 1960s here or in the UK, again, you could spend a lot of money on a theater ticket and a lot of money on an outfit and go out and be seen. But television went into your home and it was there for everyone. So there's something about Commedia that I think is so much more accessible than, you know, maybe some other more classical forms of theater.
Right. So it's a little less highbrow, much more accessible.
Yeah.
And much more familiar in a sense. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's a very intriguing parallel. Mm-hmm. Well, that's really interesting. I would not have, as you just described the basic parameters of the story, I would not have guessed that this was a play of that sort of scope in terms of technical scope and presenting the challenges that it has to you.
We have fire, we have water, we have bands, we have people like trying to drown themselves. I mean,
holy
it is
cow.
All over the place. This is a giant show.
Are they, are your actors performing it in British accent?
Oh, absolutely. And with a variety of accents too. We have sort of the more posh received pronunciation. And then we got some people who are Cockney, and we have one Jamaican and one Liverpudlian.
Oh.
And I'm not going to embarrass myself
by
attempting this.
Well, the other two you did brilliantly as far as I can
tell. I can talk like this all day.
Oh, wow. How fun. So, again, we're talking about a play that has already opened. And you know, more typically we're talking before a play opens, and then so I'm going to ask you a question like, so are you ready, and at what point are you in your prep? And of course, that's all a done deal now, so we can talk about how it went your first weekend.
You know, it's funny because Friday night, the chancellor of our university had a gathering that I spoke at, and I think several of the people that were at this gathering said to me, are you nervous? And my response was, no. our team is amazing. We have so much talent in our student body, and I mean, I assume you feel the same way about your students. They are such gifted comedians in this show, and you know, not only do we have a cast of 21, because these massive sets all have to move and it has to look like it's 1963, our full run crew is costumed as though they are run crew on a television set in the 60s, which looks very different from being a stage crew, you know, in 2018.
Yeah.
So I mean, we had rehearsals that were just to choreograph where, you know, how to make all the set pieces fit and how they go and who turns this and how long it takes. So amazing. I absolutely was not nervous because they're all so bloody talented. But it was great. You know, when you work on a comedy, when you first start rehearsing, everybody's laughing. Like, this business that you discover is so funny. And then you do it, and you do it, and you do it, and you do it. And I love working on comedy. I really feel very passionate about bringing laughter into people's lives. I feel like we need it. But I say to the actors, this is going to stop being funny. So what your job is now is to look for the truth of the character. The more truthful you are in the moment, the funnier it will be for the audience.
Right.
But it's hard because they're doing all this funny stuff and no one's laughing. So when you finally add back in the audience reacting to what they've created, the show was just exploding with life this weekend. It was so great to see.
The magic returns.
Yes.
Or one more layer of magic.
Yeah.
So when are the performances this weekend?
So we have a special Thursday night performance, which is just a $5 show for everyone. Usually we do a student rush, but we made this we just want people to come see it. It's so funny. So Thursday is a $5 performance, and then Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So Thursday, Friday, Saturday, it's a 7 p.m. performance, and then Sunday it's a matinee at 2.
And where is it?
It's at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Rita Talent Pickin Regional Center for Arts and Humanities on the main stage.
Okay, yeah, I guess a big show belongs on that.
It is a big show.
What we used to think of as the ComArts stage. And if people want tickets, how do they get information?
You can find tickets through our website, or you can go to uwparksidetickets.com or uwparksidetickets.university.com, and that'll get you there. There's also a trailer, so if you go to our website, you can see a trailer that's got clips from the show, and it's even the trailer's funny.
Fantastic. Sounds wonderful. One Man, Two Governors by Richard Bean and Jennifer Sassaman, the director. Jennifer, I am excited to try to see this play, and I hope a lot of people are similarly excited. I suspect they are after hearing your description. So thank you so much for sharing the good word about One Man and Two Governors today.
Thank you so much.
And the time here on WGTD's Morning Show is 8:38. Part two of the program is coming up, and a little later in the hour, out of the archives, a conversation with Aaron Brockovich. You're listening to the Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio.
And for part two of today's morning show, I'm happy to be speaking with Doug Instanis, who is the artistic and managing director of the Racine Theatre Guild and the director of the current production at the Theatre Guild, which opened last weekend. And the play is A Comedy of Tenors by Ken Ludwig. And if that title sounds vaguely familiar, it's because it is essentially the sequel to a very, very popular farce that's been done at least twice here since I've been in this neck of the woods, Lend Me a Tenor. So this takes that scenario a step further, and Doug Instanis has been having lots of fun at the helm of this production. Doug Instanis, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning.
So tell us first a little bit about, just a brief word about Lend Me a Tenor and its connection with the Racine Theatre Guild before we talk about the sequel.
Well, Lend Me a Tenor takes place with Tito Morelli is supposed to be coming to do a big concert, and The problem is that he's very upset. He takes some sleeping pills, and we think he dies. So then Max has to pretend to be Tito, and lots of craziness ensues, and we don't know who's going with who and who's married to who, and everybody's running through doors, slamming, lots of kissing. And Tito wakes up, of course, and now we've got two tenors both trying to do Otello, and as with all farces, everybody lives happily ever after. So basically it's Tito's story, and he's mad, and he takes sleeping pills. And so now we fast forward, you know, 10 years or so, and we have a comedy of tenors.
And does it involve this same famous tenor?
It has some of the same characters in the play, yes. Tito Morelli is back with his wife Maria, but this time we find out he has a daughter. And the daughter is in love with Carlo Nucci, who is the new up-and-coming star. Now, Tito doesn't know this. Tito thinks they sent his daughter off to boarding school to stay away from boys. And so he doesn't know that the daughter has a boyfriend. So what we find out is Tito is a little sad. He is feeling a little old. And his voice cracked in one of the songs, and he's, you know, Italian, and so everything is very dramatic, and he's going to, you know, kill himself because he's lost it. He can't live without honor and respect. And so he is feeling a little down. He's feeling a little the middle-aged blues, I guess. And so, lo and behold, Maria, his wife, catches Carlo and the daughter, making out on the couch. So she runs off, and Tito accidentally sees Carlo with his wife and thinks that his wife is having an affair. So this is where the farce starts and running in. So we've got people running in and around. So Tito's going to quit the concert. He's not going to do it because he thinks his wife's having an affair, and the manager doesn't know what to do about it. And all of a sudden, we hear this beautiful voice coming from the hallway, and we find out that Beppo, the bellhop, he has a beautiful voice, and lo and behold, he looks like Tito. So
what are the chances?
What are the chances? Same hotel. So now Beppo is going to pretend to be Tito. And so he cleans up. They put him in different clothes. And now everybody's confused. Are we talking to Tito? Are we talking to Beppo? And that's, as any good farce, mistaken identity, people coming and going. And so at the end of the show, not to give away all these great secrets, but we do this concert, and Beppo and Tito actually go out on stage together, and that's part of the fun. You know, he's coming out of one door. Poor Davidson Kane, who plays both Beppo and Tito, he does a costume change, and then he runs to one door, and he's Beppo, and then he changes his clothes and runs to another door, and he's Tito. And so I think that's part of the fun, that the audience really likes to see poor Davidson Kane running back and forth playing multiple roles.
Oh, boy. And if I remember correctly, he was Tito Morelli the second time, or the most recent time, that the Theater Guild did Lend Me a Tenor.
Right. Both Tito Morelli, Davidson Kane, and Shannon Thill, who was Maria, his wife, have come back, as well as Paul Weir, who is Saunders, who is the manager, who's the producer of the event. So we got three of them coming back playing the same roles, and then Christy Burgess Martino is playing on the show again, except for she's playing a different role. She played a different opera star in the first play, and now she's playing a Russian opera star in this play. So four of the original cast members are back, and so we're very glad for that.
I remember from seeing Lend Me a Tenor, that was a farce. I mean, straight-up farce. I mean, that the textbook farce, I guess, is what we mean. And I assume that a comedy of tenors also is very much a farce in the same...
It is. Coming and going, people coming through different doors. A very broad comedy, very silly, but it has a little heart to it. You know, as being a dad myself and getting a little bit older, you know, we get a little worried about our legacy, and we get a little worried about our children. And so, you know, this family is full of love and full of passion, And it's a lot of fun. It's very silly. It's very fun. It's not brain surgery, so you got to kind of put your brain at, check your brain at the door when you come in.
Hmm. How hard is a farce like this to direct? I mean, I think most of us from the audience, probably most of the time when we see plays, we tend to kind of underestimate just how much a director has to do. But I think usually when you see a farce, I think at least most of in the audience are impressed not only by what we're seeing on the stage in terms of the actors, but the director behind the scenes who put all of that intricacy together. Is it as hard to direct a farce as we assume?
I think it is. I think it's one of the hardest things to direct, and it's one of the hardest things for me because I don't like to sit down and work on the choreography. And basically, it's all choreography. Come through that door, hit the pooch on this line. You open the door, you close the door. You come up, you stand, you sit. And on our stage, being a thrust, it's very important that we share focus. And it's a little bit more difficult in a proscenium stage where the person that's downstage has the focus. So with us, timing is everything, and we have to work very hard at making sure people are looking where they're supposed to be, not seeing things that they're not supposed to see, and that the timing of the cast is impeccable. One door closes, the other one opens. You don't want to wait 2 seconds for it, or you want to be early. Because that ruins the joke. And I'm very lucky I've got this amazing cast. And Ken Ludwig does not help you. He he likes to do these massive curtain calls in Lend Me a Tenor. Everybody does the play from the beginning to the end in 90 seconds. That's what curtain call is in Lend Me a Tenor. And so in this play, he wants you to do it again. And because of scene changes, we do the entire play backwards. So that is a feat in a sense. So in curtain call, the entire cast has to recreate the show going backwards to forwards. And, you know, run, hit, kiss, kiss this person, get hit by the door, fall on the ground, pull the covers off, back and forth. So it's crazy and it's fun. And I'm very blessed to have such a wonderful cast that make it all possible.
And we should mention that this is something I'm aware of because I helped out a little bit, that some of your cast had to learn some Italian opera and be ready to sing it in Italian. So not the kind of challenge that the typical actor typically faces.
That's another problem with Ken Ludwig. He he does these shows, and right in the middle you put an opera. And so you make these actors have to sing. So, yes, it is. It also happens in Lend Me a Tenor where they do the same thing. But now three guys have to practice for the upcoming opera. So they'll do a little bit of singing, a little bit of Italian singing, and it's fun. And it just shows you all these guys can sing. So I hope people enjoy it.
So it opened this past weekend. How many more weekends does it run?
We have one more weekend. We play Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and we close this Sunday.
Wow. So if people are interested in tickets, what do they do?
They should call the box office at 262-633-4218. You can order tickets online at www.racinetheater.org or just come to the box office and buy them at the door.
And real quick, what finishes out the season after A Comedy of Tenors?
Sister Act. We open that in May, just like the movie. It's not just like the movie. I shouldn't say that. It's based on the movie with Whoopi Goldberg. Same idea. Dolores, the soulful nun, goes into the convent and raises the rafters and teaches everybody a different way to celebrate the Lord. And it's a wonderful show, lots of great music, lots of dancing nuns. How can you go wrong with dancing nuns?
Right.
So I hope people will come out for that.
Very good. And at the time that we do an interview about Sister Act, we'll also talk about next season at the Theater Guild, which has just been announced and promises to be quite exciting. So we'll save that for another time. In the meantime, Doug Instanis at the helm for this current production of A Comedy of Tenors. This weekend is your last opportunity to see it at the Racine Theater Guild. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
And the time is 8:49 here on WGTD, and we finish out today's morning show with a conversation out of the morning show archives from about 10 years ago. We all know the name Erin Brockovich and the tireless work which first put her on the map, trying to make the world a little bit safer, especially for ordinary people who, for no fault of their own, find themselves living in the wake of environmental damage. And now, in addition to that work which she has continued to do, Erin Brockovich is a very fine writer, and she has co-written a couple of well-received novels, the most recent of which is called Hot Water. And we're going to talk with her for the next few minutes about this next step in her journey. Erin Brockovich, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. I look forward to talking to you very much.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
A couple of novels, Rock Bottom and now Hot Water, which obviously spring out of this real-life crusade of yours to make the world a bit safer for ordinary families. Could you tell us how this started? Was this something that somebody suggested to you, or on your own did you realize that this might be a fun and fruitful undertaking for you?
Well, you know, I've been 21 years, gosh, I hate to date myself, that I've actually been working with communities on environmental issues. And, you know, it's been over the past few years I see... Oh, I don't know. I'd say despair in communities, and it's just such an overwhelming concept to hear or face that through groundwater contamination or air pollution or soil vapor plumes underneath people's homes that they have environmental problems. And sometimes it gets so overwhelming, we just tune out. We turn on that deaf ear. And the idea of... the novels, and we call them a cause novel, is to have a character in there that many people would relate to, that they could just have some escapism, if you will, and read something, but close the book and go, wait a minute, that is a real cause. It could be happening in this country. It could be, frankly, happening in my own backyard, and I want to get involved. So that was the idea, just seeing communities often... I'm thinking, oh, I just can't deal with this, or I don't want to deal with this. And so AJ is a fun character, and it's a series based on things that might really be happening and a way to get people to want to become involved.
We're talking about an environmental activist named Angela Joy Palladino, and obviously she is a very powerful echo of you and some of the work that you've done. How would you characterize her in terms of being similar to you versus being distinct from you? I mean, have you and co-author C.J. Lyons gone out of your way to make her a lot like you or different from you? How have you handled that?
Well, certainly somewhat like me, but possibly, you know, I guess like a whole lot of people might be. And so it's a little bit of me in there, but AJ kind of has a... She's maybe a little more jaded in some regards, but that's what I love about her. She's rolling her eyes a lot of times, and sometimes things pop out of her mouth that's something that every one of us would want to say, but we just don't, and neither do I, so I love that part of AJ. So she's a little bit of me, but she's a lot relatable to many, many people, and especially, you know, women, and she has a child that has a disability, and, you know, AJ's just... her heartstrings are pulled upon a lot, and she wants to do right by people, but she's a little jaded, a little cynical. She's pretty up in your face and can get away with things that I don't know that I necessarily could. That makes her fun.
Sure. She is in this book approached by the owner of a brand new nuclear facility, mm-hmm. and is offered a very, very sizable check to come on board to actually not investigate wrongdoing, but kind of the opposite, to try to quell public unrest and concern about this nuclear facility. And because of her situation, she finds this monetary possibility very, very tempting. Speak a moment about folding this into the story, because I'm sure this is also a reality that activists sometimes have to face.
Well, you know, I think it's a reality a lot of times people face. I mean, the money is something that can help AJ, the law firm where she works. It can help them do more work and the right thing by a whole lot more people. It would be something that's important to her, again, with a disabled child. And I think that every single person in America, you know, wants a job and wants to earn money. And she's just afraid that the money is there for the wrong reason. Now, in this particular situation with AJ in this series, it's a catch-22. Many people are afraid of nuclear energy. We don't understand it. We have questions surrounding it. And then, of course, if there's a nuclear problem, it can be a terrible disaster. So people don't want this facility in their community. And the company brought AJ in to try to get the community to trust or believe in or allow the company to exist. And they're also developing medical isotopes. And AJ, having a disabled child, understands that, on the other hand, this nuclear facility and medical isotopes could actually enhance somebody's health. It could actually change and save somebody's life. So it's a catch-22 for her, and she's agonizing a little, but she does want to build a trust between this company and this community. And it's along those way that, once again, AJ uncovers that there is a deception. And that's the tragedy in this book and in many of these circumstances, is that this secret that is kept, this deception, doesn't have to happen. And if we could just expose that and be forthwith at the beginning, we would have a greater transparency between this company and this community.
Well, and potential problems could be so much more better addressed.
Absolutely.
This character not only echoes who you are and have been, but also echoes recent events in Japan, of course. In your novel, there is a hurricane bearing down on the coast of South Carolina, where
right.
this nuclear facility is located. And, of course, that offers up another potential wrinkle in all of this, of Mother Nature sometimes getting involved in some disastrous ways.
Yeah, we can be better prepared. That is certain. You know, Mother Nature is not going to go away. And what happened in Japan was terrible. And I think it raises questions for all of us that, you know, possibly having nuclear facilities in earthquake-prone territories might not be a good idea. And Japan's, you know, this is one of the few options that they have. So it's very important to be better prepared. And, yes, that does raise questions for them. In the book Hot Water.
Mm.
But again, it brings to light, as we were discussing earlier, the need for being honest out the beginning and even addressing and saying this could be a potential problem. It isn't until once we recognize that there's this potential for a problem, then we can look for a solution. So we do, when we have facilities that we know could, if there's a problem, be a disaster to many, many people, we need to become even better prepared, inform the community of that, and educate the community in that. And so some of these points are brought out in the book that are actually happening throughout America. But again, we hope told in a way that's entertaining and suspenseful, that people will want to be more educated, be more aware, be more involved, because that's where we'll begin to find better solutions for our companies and our safety.
This new novel, Hot Water, is published by Vanguard Press. Aaron Brockovich, thank you very much. Best wishes and keep up the good fight.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That morning show interview out of the archives was actually recorded back in 2007. 2011. Tomorrow on the morning show, we are going to be previewing with Nan Calvert the upcoming EcoFest. We'll be talking with several people who are involved in this festival. On Friday, Amy Bass, she is the author of a really interesting book called One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought Together a Town Torn Apart. And this is the story of the soccer team of the Lewiston, Maine High School that achieved great, great success with a team that was comprised mostly of Somalian refugees. And on Monday, rescheduled from this past Monday, Dan Gitan from the Kenosha News with his investigative research into corruption in the hospice care industry. His work is going to be featured Monday night on an episode of the CNBC series